All right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today's show, at the back end of the show, we're going to be having a very special, special segment, and that is a chance to talk with Miles Soleil from the band Outer National. And we'll be bringing to you their latest EP, an EP called Here is the Rose. And this EP was done to stand against the oppression of women everywhere and in solidarity with the Billion Rising movement. So stay tuned for that. And in the middle segment of the show, we're going to be talking with Salman Abu Sita from the Palestine Land Society. Now, Salman is joining us to talk about the history of the occupation of Palestine, not just the occupation of Palestine. All right, let's be real here. He's joining us to talk about the theft of the land from the Palestinian people. When the Zionists came to Palestine, it was not a situation of a land without people for a people without land. There were people there. They were Palestinian people. And the Zionists came in and set in motion an entire genocidal movement against the Palestinian people. And that's what Salman Abu Sita is going to be talking with us about, the history of that and what's behind it. Opening the show up, I am really pleased to welcome back to the show a person who always brings insight and, you know, some gripping knowledge to the show when he appears. He's Richard Falk, and he's the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. And he's just returned a couple months ago from a visit to Palestine in the wake of the Israeli assault on Gaza. Has a lot to say about what's going on there, and including, which we'll get into a little bit later in the discussion with him, the way he's come under attack by various forces for standing up and fighting. For the interests of the Palestinian people in the world. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be with you.
Great, man. Well, let's jump into this. Towards the end of the last year, you were able to enter Gaza. And was this the first time that you've been able to do this as the UN Special Rapporteur?
Yes, it's the first time. I've been there since I had this position. I had been to Gaza twice before, once for a UN fact-finding mission back in 2002, and once to attend the first human rights meeting ever held in Gaza, which was in the late 1990s during the early honeymoon period of the Oslo peace process.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that, you know, you obviously clearly learned a lot about the dynamics of what's going on in Gaza during those visits, but also over the years you've gathered up a lot of information from other sources, from secondhand sources, from indirect sources. So what I'd ask you is, having gone to Gaza, what did you find? Did you find anything that surprised you, or what did you find that you were able to actually get a better understanding of by visiting there?
Well, it was a short visit, but very intense, and gave me some awareness that you can only have by the direct experience of what the people living under a blockade that has lasted for more than 5 years, with continuous incursions of violence that can be at any moment without warning. And it is that's extraordinary, to be in a place where there's no escape from what might be regarded as a permanent war zone. And to grow up in that kind of atmosphere is something that I don't think any of us can appreciate without having been there. And even then, as a short-time visitor, you don't get the depth of feeling that seems to affect the population that has been born, grown up, and died in Gaza under conditions either of this kind of constant threat of violence for which there is no real response, and a sense of being confined within this crowded, impoverished area. At the same time, there was a big difference from the time I had been there a decade earlier, and that was the so-called Israeli disengagement, which occurred in 2005, didn't end the occupation, which continues by controlling the border, the airspace, and the waterfront. But what has changed is that without the Israeli armored personnel carriers with machine guns perched on their top, patrolling the streets, you do have within Gaza a greater sense of normalcy, that people can, under these severe constraints that I've described, live their life without having constantly to confront either Israeli military forces or checkpoints throughout the Gaza Strip. So in that sense, the situation is different in a better way, I think, for the people. Also, they had just survived this latest attack in November that caused devastation and involved some attacks on residential areas where lots of children were killed. And this is always traumatizing, not only for the victims and their families, but for the communities as a whole. And again, speaking with those people who had just endured this kind of tragedy does give you a different existential understanding of what's going on there. Mm-hmm. One more thing is that aside from these problems that are created by the Israeli occupation and concept of how to deal with Gaza, is the underlying situation caused by insufficient and polluted water, by insufficient land for agriculture, and a sense that the future of the Gaza Strip is very much at risk. The UN has published a careful study that suggests that by 2020, Gaza will become uninhabitable, which is a horrible prospect considering that 1.6 million people live there. And some of the experts we spoke to while I was there suggested that that was too optimistic, that by 2016, it's likely that it will not be possible to really sustain a viable society in Gaza. And already there's a health crisis, and many people are forced to rely on impure water for drinking and washing. So it's a very, the underlying infrastructure is very much at risk in Gaza.
Yeah. Just a quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. You know, you've described a lot of the things that you're describing. You've talked about in a broad sense as collective punishment of a whole people, which actually is a war crime. And I'm thinking about this in relation to how you're looking at all this stuff happening and a couple of things that you've spoken to more recently, including in your speech in Cairo on the Solidarity with Palestinian People Day. You know, the point of not just the collective punishment, but the idea that settler colonialism and the idea that there's now 600,000 settlers permanently living in the occupied territories and what that means for the future of the Palestinian people. I mean, there's one thing about and this is horrendous and just unthinkable that Gaza could be by 2016 uninhabitable. You know, this is outrageous. And then you think about what's happening and what that has to do with settler colonialism.
Yes, Michael, I'm glad you raised that because I think it's an extraordinarily illuminating way of thinking about the whole ordeal of the Palestinians. At the very historical moment when colonialism was collapsing throughout the world, Israel and Zionism has launched this new colonial project of a massive character with the backing of the United States and has been able to reverse the trend of history so far as the Palestinian people are concerned. So they're living not only under an oppressive occupation or in refugee camps and in exile, but they're also victimized by this new form of settler colonialism that has taken their resources, including the most fundamental ones like water and land, and has subjugated an entire people, not only the people of Gaza, to a situation for which one finds no prospect of a solution. And the talk about two-state consensus that will provide Palestinians with their right of self-determination is empty talk. The settlements contradict that, and recently, after the General Assembly voted to regard the Palestine as a state without membership in the UN, Netanyahu used that as an excuse to launch a new cycle of dramatically expanding the existing settlements and defying world public opinion, even U.S. opinion on the legality, morality, and political prudence of engaging in further settlement activity. So it is a very dire picture, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine, Richard Falk. Now, Richard, as you talked about that, I kept thinking about another point you've hit on quite often, too. You talked about just now about opinion in the U.S., and the opinion in the U.S. is one thing, but the actual drive and needs and what this whole U.S. imperialism is pushed to do, there's a question that you've raised in terms of the geopolitics of the region and what they're trying to refashion in that part of the world and how that plays in with the what's happening, what's being done to the Palestinian people. And then again, too, the idea that you talked about, which I found very, very important, the significance of Israel's ambassador to the U.S. saying that the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza, that it was Israel wasn't confronting Gaza, but Iran, and it should be understood as a rehearsal for militarily engaging Iran. These are some pretty heavy things in terms of geopolitics.
No question. And it's very hard to disentangle what is done on behalf of America's grand strategy in the region, which, of course, centers not only on Israel, but on the energy resources there. The countries that have been subject to military intervention are oil-producing countries, Libya and Iraq, and Iran is on the list of countries that are threatened with an attack and have been, and it too is, of course, a major oil producer. So one has this resource dimension that is intertwined with the unconditional support of Israeli politics in the region that probably are present in the Syrian conflict and elsewhere, perhaps in relation to the Kurdish unrest in different parts of the region, so that it's a very complicated but important arena of post-Cold War diplomacy in the name of American grand strategy, and which has shifted from its earlier European focus to the Middle East and to some extent to Asia in the relation to China. So we do have a new kind of geopolitical landscape in the world. That is being challenged, of course, in part by the rise of some of these non-Western countries such as China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey to some extent. So we need to really understand what is happening. And, of course, the Palestinians are caught between these various pressures. And with the recent upheavals in the Arab world, the Palestinian plight and struggle has been, at least in the international relations, has been marginalized to an unfortunate degree.
Well, let me ask you this, Richard, because that gets right to this question. You've talked about, in some of your recent writings, this new thing that's sort of being appearing on the international scene, the responsibility to protect, and that being an international norm, a new international norm to guide the UN in responding to situations of humanitarian catastrophe. And you point out very sharply that yet, with even that being the case, it's never applied to the suffering of the Palestinian people at the hands of the Zionist regime.
Yes, well, that Michael, goes to the degree to which the UN is not an alternative to geopolitics, but an instrument of geopolitics. And especially since the end of the Cold War and the different orientation taken to global issues by Russia, the Western powers have more or less a free hand in determining where that responsibility should be exercised and where it should be suppressed. And so you have at one extreme Libya, and at the other extreme the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Not the plight or need of a people that is vulnerable and enduring a humanitarian catastrophe, but rather the political priorities of the countries that exercise this geopolitical leverage.
We're talking with Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. Now, let me ask you this, Richard, because we're coming up on our time and I have a couple more questions that I know are going to be really that I want to get into. For all of your work in relation to the occupied territories of Palestine, you've come under attack a number of times around a number of things. And, you know, partly it's been, you know, you've come under attack from the Israeli regime. You've come under attack from various conservative groupings around the world. And most recently, you've come under attack from a group called UN Watch, as well as the Human Rights Watch here in the U.S. Is there anything you want to tell people about that? I mean, it seems to me there's been a lot of attempts at character assassination and really trying to sort of discredit you so they can move you off the scene and stop you saying what you're saying about Palestine.
Yes. I mean, I have been attacked since I took this UN job by UN Watch, which really should be called Israel Watch. It is not concerned with any issues other than protecting Israeli interests. And one principal way they do that is by attacking anyone that has an independent role or is critical of Israel. And this kind of extreme Zionism has redefined anti-Semitism to mean any criticism of Zionism or Israel rather than hatred of Jews, which is, of course, the underlying idea, and to me, the real idea, core idea of what anti-Semitism represents. But I'm accused by UN Watch all the time of being anti-Semitic and racist, and there's not a shred of evidence that supports that, and it's far from my real views. Human Rights Watch is a liberal organization that does good work in various countries, but is sensitive about identifying with someone like myself, who is seen as a critic of Israel, as I say, and has this UN job. So they didn't identify with the UN Watch attack, but what they were unwilling to do was to disassociate themselves from it when it was distorted by UN Watch publicly, so that the little incident which occurred was that UN Watch sent this defamatory letter to Ken Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, and he invoked a technicality about not having a conflicting role in government or the UN to remove me from Santa Barbara City Committee of Human Rights Watch, which was pretty ineffectual role that I had here for several years, even before I had the UN appointment. And then when UN Watch issued a press release saying that I'd been dismissed and expelled by Human Rights Watch in response to the its attack, Roth and Human Rights Watch was unwilling to disassociate, correct that impression. And so they left that impression in the public, and I've been attacked in France by other groups, Zionist groups, and elsewhere in the world. So it's a kind of unpleasant incident.
Yeah, absolutely. Unpleasant, and actually something that people really need to have your back on in terms of showing support for what you're doing and what you're saying. Now, one more question, Richard Falk, and this is one that I think you personify in what you're doing. You've made the point that you've joined with others who've called the denial of Palestinian rights the greatest moral issue of our times. Why?
Because it has been before us for a very long time. It has captured the moral imagination of many people in the world. That statement was initially made by Nelson Mandela, who is himself a kind of icon of moral sensitivity and of a struggle for the rights of an oppressed people. And I think no other issue has as strong a global reach and resonance as this one. Doesn't mean that there are not more people being killed in other places like Congo and maybe Myanmar. But what it does mean is that this issue, and especially for Americans, because we're so complicit in what's happened to the Palestinian people, this issue hangs over our collective reality like a continuous dark storm cloud that I think erodes and diminishes any claim we make to be a moral beacon for the world as a source of democracy and human rights and the like. It is a permanent indication of a fundamental hypocrisy and double standard.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. And let me ask you real quick, you know, I'm going to give you about 3 minutes, but I know you can do it. You know, what's next? What's up in the future? You've talked about there's already troubling signs that Israel is undermining and in effect laying the foundation to ignore the ceasefire. You've also got, you know, things that you're talking about going from the speaking realm to actually advocating for certain activities to happen in support of the Palestinian people. What's next?
Well, I've said in the UN setting particularly, that the time for mere rhetoric has long passed and that it's time to take concrete action. In my last report to the UN General Assembly, we supported the BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign that's growing around the world, and named particular companies that, including some prominent American ones, that have profited from their dealings with the unlawful settlements. We focused on these companies particularly because they represented a way of attacking the issue concretely, tangibly, and built a link that has been established for the first time between what the UN is trying to say about the Israel-Palestine conflict and what civil society has been trying to do through the BDS campaign and other initiatives.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Yeah,
take care.
You too, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Richard Falk, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Salman Abu Sita from the Palestine Land Society. So stay tuned. Right, welcome back. That was Dance of Drums from Mohammed Al-Hassan Abu Abid. Today's show, in large part, is about making sure that as Obama goes over to embrace the Zionist, the fascist state of Israel, and talk about, oh, how much he really cares about the Israeli people and the Israeli government, and meanwhile, and even offers some crocodile tears about the Palestinian people, but meanwhile is standing behind Israel and its genocidal assault on the Palestinian people. And in terms of that, I wanted to be able to give you some context, some background for understanding why we talk about the theft of the land from the Palestinian people, why we actually insist that people understand that the founding of Israel was not based on a land without people for a people without land, but in fact was a land that was stolen from many millions of Palestinian people. So I decided that I'd go back and talk to someone who's been deeply involved in and knowledgeable about the original land seizure of Palestine by Zionist forces backed up by various imperialist powers around the world, including most essentially the U.S. imperialists. That's what contextualizes the whole situation in Palestine today, the theft of the Palestinian land in order to establish the state of Israel. Now, to start things off, I'm going to read a few sentences from an article recently written by my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and director of the Palestine Land Society. In May 2012, Senator Mark Kirk made an astounding discovery, which had escaped scores of politicians, diplomats, and experts for six decades. He discovered that the number of Palestinian refugees is not 5 million, as United Nations Relief and Works Agency records show, but merely 30,000. The credit for this discovery goes to AIPAC and Israel, as they had advanced this so-called discovery for the last 4 months. Kirk took the signal and proposed a motion to Congress, which was passed after a mild amendment. Dispossessed Palestinians will remain dispossessed Palestinians with no recourse. Those are the words of my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. Salman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Let's jump right into this. When I read your article, it was like sticking a pin in my eye. I paid a lot of attention to what's going on with the Palestinian people, and then seeing this just drove home again this whole question of the dispossession of the Palestinian people, and I wanted to talk with you about it. You make the point, you say it's impossible to examine the Palestinian land ownership in occupied Palestine outside the context of the general Palestine-Israel conflict. Can you explain what you mean there and why you say that?
The tragedy of Palestine is very clear. In 1948, Israeli forces, mainly composed of Jewish immigrants from Europe, took over Palestine by force, by military force. They have depopulated 675,000 villages within 6 months of 1948. Thus, we have the problem of refugees. The purpose of Zionism is threefold. Number one, to take over the land of Palestine. Two, to get rid of the people of Palestine by resettlement anywhere else except in their homes, is to erase their history and memory. And so we have in this case the largest, most comprehensive, meticulously executed ethnic cleansing in modern history. And this problem persists till today. 64 years later, the Palestinians are unable to go back and live in their own homes. The land, which is called Israel today, 93% of it is Palestinian-owned. And this is the land of the refugees who are now scattered around Palestine and elsewhere.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, because you just made the statement that this, the expulsion of the Palestinian people, the seizure of the land, the theft of the land, was the largest planned, comprehensive, and still continuous ethnic cleansing operation in modern history. Can you get into that a little bit more? How did that play out?
In 1948, the Israeli forces occupied 78% of Palestine. In 1967, they occupied all of Palestine and parts of Syria and Sinai and later part of Lebanon. Now they still have 100% of Palestine and all Golan Heights in Syria. Now the whole world, through the international community, has declared that this is illegal under international law. The International Court of Justice has made a specific decree that the occupation of the West Bank by Israel and indeed all of Palestine is illegal under international law. There are more than 135 UN resolutions confirming or affirming the right of Palestinians to return to their homes, but Israel never comprehended complied with that, although it is a condition for its membership in the United Nations. Why it didn't do that? Because of the support of the United States through the Israel lobby and the United States.
Now, one of the things, though, it wasn't like they just walked in and started buying up the land, or they started just telling Palestinians, well, sorry, but we own your house now, you got to get out. When you're talking about ethnic cleansing, you're talking about something that actually is a crime against humanity. It's actually something that the Nuremberg Tribunal basically said that this was a criminal act. And the Israelis were very, very, very vicious in the cleansing of Palestine. You refer to something in one of your pieces, you refer to something called the Green Patrol, which gave me a very sharp example of how they carried this out. Can you tell my listeners what the Green Patrol is and what it had to do with ethnic cleansing?
Before the Green Patrol, which started in 1950, in 1948, the Israelis carried out 31 military operations to take over 78% of Palestine. In each of these operations, at the beginning and in the middle, they have committed a massacre of a village, a total of about 77 atrocities and massacres. This was intended to propel the people and make them leave their homes. In fact, each village, the standard procedure was that each village was surrounded from three times, and the fourth side is left open for people to escape. They would kill a number of young men, and they take the rest to concentration camps where they were taken to forced labor camps. We have uncovered five visited by the Red Cross, and we have the documents in Geneva to prove it, but we have also uncovered 17 other forced labor camps through the testimony of the witnesses. Now, all this was carried out in 1948-49. If anyone tried to return home, they were shot and killed by the Israelis as being infiltrators. If you return to your home, you are an infiltrator. But the one who came from Europe through the shores of Palestine, infiltrated into the land of Palestine, is not considered to be an infiltrator. Now, after 1950, some Palestinians remained, very, very few, or almost 10 or 15%. When these people remained on their own land, the Israelis created something called Green Patrol, which went around and demolished their houses and actually put toxic material in their crops and killed their cattle in order to make them move. These were and are Israeli citizens. That happened after 1948, and these people were not refugees, but Israeli citizens. So this process, as you have said, is continuous until today. Today is course carried out not only inside Israel, in Al-Araqib, in Beersheba district, but also in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it plays out in these examples. For instance, one thing that we hear a lot about is the so-called Israeli settlers that move into the occupied territories and then claim them as their holy land, their promised land, and they get backed up by the military. And there's a constant confrontation with the Palestinian people who are saying, no, get out. Do you see this as a continuation of that same ethnic cleansing?
It is absolutely a continuation. It is done today through slightly different means. Instead of being military force in 1948 and 49, it's done now by subtle ways and not so subtle ways. Let us remember that the International Court of Justice in 2004 has clearly declared that the occupation of the West Bank is illegal under international law, and that means under the Rome Statute of 1998, which is the foundation of the International Criminal Court, declares clearly that the people of the occupier or the occupying force should not be settled on the occupied land. If they do, this is, of course, a crime against humanity, a crime against peace, and a war crime. Therefore, legally speaking, all the settlers in the West Bank are war criminals. And the Israelis deny that the West Bank is an occupied territory. They are the only people who claim that. Even the United States doesn't claim that. The whole world claims it is an occupied territory. So here you have not only the settlers taking Palestinian land in the land that was occupied in 1967, but also they take their water. 90% of the water of the West Bank is taken over by the Israelis, and they are left thirsty. Not only that, even South Africa did not dare to do that. They have Jews-only roads. If you are a Palestinian in the West Bank, you are not allowed to drive on roads allocated for Jews. When Bishop Desmond Tutu visited, he said, I know apartheid very well, but this is in the West Bank and Palestine, This is worse than apartheid.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and people of Palestine. And we're talking about the ethnic cleansing that is a continuous thing going on in Palestine and the Zionist forces behind it from the very beginning. Now, Salman, you talked about this, the objectives of the Zionist master plan of ethnic cleansing, and you went through them, the land to conquer it, confiscate it, deny its original ownership, the people to kill them in massacres, expel them, chase them into exile, or make their lives unbearable. There's also this thing about the identity and to erase any physical sign of the Palestinian presence, destruction of villages, monuments, holy sites, to change maps and delete Arabic names and replace them with Hebrew names and erase their mention in history and geography books. And I noticed that a lot of your writing really concentrates on trying to combat that. Why is this so important? Why did the Zionists go after this so hard?
Well, from the beginning of the 20th century, the Zionists have sold the European politicians, colonial politicians, the idea that Palestine is a land without people and the Jews are people without land, therefore let us get the two together. Now, this is a myth, and this myth was well known to the colonial powers themselves, the British and the French, because in the 19th century, they made surveys of Palestine, and they found, and we have all the maps today, they found that there are 1,000 towns and villages in Palestine, and some of them are actually recorded and known since the times of Jesus Christ. Now, why do they do that? Because they wanted to prove that they have not committed a sin or a crime against anybody. This is an empty territory. Now, we have to show that this is, of course, entirely false. So I worked for almost 20 years collecting documents from various European capitals, but mainly England and the United Nations and New York, Washington, in order to reconstruct the maps of Palestine, which has been erased by the Zionists. We have great difficulty because we are not yet a state, and I'm only a researcher, and therefore I have no authority to demand documents from government. But over 20 years, we have assembled the Atlas of Palestine, 1917 to 1960, 700 pages. It has the following. It has 1,600 towns and villages. It has 16,000 historical and religious monuments, and it has 26,000 place names. All these names, a total of about 50,000, are what I call the vocabulary of the social history of Palestine. It was not created by committee. It was created by the people in their course of life. For example, the Pigeon Valley, the olive fields, and so on and so forth. And this is, to me, a great testimony of the life of the people who have been rooted in Palestine for thousands of years. When Ben-Gurion was told that we have taken over Palestine and people will not accept it, he said, the young will forget and the old will die. Well, they all did die, but not before they tell their children about their patrimony, and the Atlas is a record of this patrimony.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, and we're talking about the dispossession of the land and people of Palestine. Now, Salman, we have a couple of questions left to ask, and one is, there's always the thing that the U.S. imperialists are always putting out to people and always putting out around the world, and the Israelis are right behind them and pumping it out. The only democratic regime in the entire Middle East, you know, whatever. The whole idea that the people who are living in Israel and in occupied Palestine, that they have recourse to legal rights. Yet, I'd ask you this. The situation, as you say, continues to be ethnic cleansing. What legal recourse do the Palestinian people have today in occupied Palestine, in what the Zionists call Israel?
You know, let me say this. Israel is the only racist country in the world today. There are many countries which practice racism in a subtle way and in a social way. But Israel is the only racist country through its institutions and through its laws. There are 25 basic laws in Israel, at least, which discriminate against anyone who is not a Jew. Even though, and this applies to Jews who are not also citizens of Israel, they have the same rights like Jews who are in Israel. These basic laws discriminate against anybody who is not a Jew in the following manner: in the land ownership, in the land use, in education, in health, in employment, in family unity. If you are married to a Palestinian woman from the West Bank, you cannot bring your wife to Israel if you are Palestinian living there. But a Jew can bring an Australian or an American wife or anywhere from anywhere to Israel. The world has condemned Israel so many times in the Human Rights Council, and only last week, CERD, which is the Committee for Elimination of All Traces of Racism, has censored Israel very clearly about its practices. And this practice is continuing on today. You probably recall the case of a village called Araqib in Beersheba, and the Israeli government demolished the village for over 36 times. And this is obviously has been also condemned by European Parliament only last week. So Israel has the dubious distinction of being the most racist state in the world. The people in Europe and somewhat in America have, because of internet and television and so on, have really seen the reality behind the myth that Israel is democracy. 70% of people in Europe say that Israel is a danger to the world peace.
Let me ask you this, Salman. Real quick, you made a comment in a couple of your writings, in a couple of places, you made the comment that the Palestinians cannot depend on the Israeli legal system because Israeli law is the law of the conqueror, and it's designed to deprive the vanquished of their rights. And you also made a similar point around international law. Can you talk about that a little bit as the last question?
Yes, there is a simple adage which we can find somewhat useful here. I say, under the robber's law, you cannot retrieve the stolen goods. And this has been proven over and over again. But if you allow me, just let me say one thing before we go. There is now, by the Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters in the United States, a vicious campaign against UNRWA. Why is that? Because UNRWA is the last element of the international law about Palestine, which is in operation. And as in a typical crime, if you find the body of the victim, then there is a crime. So the Israeli supporters are trying to eliminate the body of the victim. And if there is no UNRWA, there is no refugees, and therefore there is no crime. And this, of course, is a vain hope, because Palestinians are not only 5 as registered with the United Nations, but they are 7.4 million, because some of them are not registered. And I have shown this in the Atlas, because it's very simple exercise. The British have made a census in 1945, and we have the names of villages from which people were expelled, and we can know these villages and the population therefrom. And we can calculate that. It is found in one of my books called the Nakba Register. And the fact that they have stayed 64 years away from their homes and they have no intention of abandoning their right to go to their homes, which are very frequently a few miles away, then the peace can never come to the Middle East without the return of the refugees to their homes, which is a basic and fundamental human right.
Okay, Salman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, and keep up your work, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, a group dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. We're going to take an extended musical break, and during that time, you're going to be listening to a song from the band Outer National, because when we come back, we're going to be talking about the new EP from Outer National, Here is the Rose. So check this out.
I'm listening, I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a heat wave through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when
right, all right, all right. That's Outer National. It's the latest EP from Outer National. Outer National is a killer, killer band, one of my favorite bands in the world. And this is their EP dedicated to the fight to stop the oppression of women. And joining us to talk about this, talk about all that, is one of my favorite people in the world, Miles Soleil. Miles is the vocalist and the all-around ball of energy on the stage for the band Outer National. All right, so check this out. Don't walk away. Listen up. Miles, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. Glad to be on the air.
Sure, man. Well, let's jump into that. That was Here is the Rose, and that's the title of this four-track EP you put out. Let's talk about that. What's behind this? What's up with this EP?
We took a bunch of songs that we had written and recorded at different points, and we packaged them together and began releasing them on February 14th of this year, which was considered V-Day, which was sort of a movement around the world of people speaking out against sexual violence against women. And we took sort of a number of our songs that were either about women, the oppression of women, liberation of women, and then songs that also were like the one that you just played, Here is the Rose, trying to speak in an ideological and metaphorical way about a lot of people's acquiescence to the things they know are wrong, that they're sitting back and letting happen. So we wanted to take a number of these songs and release them, and that culminated with it being packaged as an EP on March 8th, which was International Women's Day. We released four songs, and that was the first one, Here is the Rose.
Well, let's talk about this point you made about ideological and metaphorically speaking to a lot of people, sort of conciliating with things that they know is wrong. How do you get that in this song?
Well, this song, interestingly enough, the phrase, Here is the Rose, Now Dance, is Hic Rhodus, Hic Salta, which I actually got from reading an essay by Karl Marx called The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. And Karl Marx was quoting Aesop, one of Aesop's fables, the Greek Aesop. And so the idea of Here is the Rose in this song was trying to envision it, and sort of this song was trying to imagine that idea of Here is the Rose, Now Dance, in a literal way. Like if you can imagine kind of like a sock hop, somebody just sort of hugging the wall and not actually sort of throwing themselves into it, maybe being too concerned about how they're perceived or maybe even how well they dance. And also figuratively in terms of the larger issues that right now, one thing that's really problematic in the world right now is that we're not dealing with the apathy that maybe we had 10, 15 years ago. We've got many people who are aware that there's something that's wrong or many things that are wrong, but yet many people are passive and acquiesce in the face of stuff. And so this was kind of like, hey, you know, come on down from the rafters, get off the wall. Here is the rose, now dance.
Mm-hmm. Really great. It's a really great song. I really like the song. I've played it probably about a dozen times today alone. Just waiting to talk with you. So let me, I wanted to ask you a couple other things, but I want to also give people a chance to hear as much of the EP as they can. So I want to play a song that is particularly compelling to me, and it's one that I heard way back when you guys first started recording on the big scale, when you first started recording. And this song in particular was one that was just very, very beautiful and very compelling, and it's She Craves Spring. And I wanna play that for people, and then we can talk about that and what's behind that and what you're thinking on that is. And just, you know, I want people to really just soak in for a little bit. So I'll play about 2 minutes of that as well, all right?
Okay.
I wonder the past of the city,
All right, welcome back. Miles, that was She Craves Spring. Tell us a little bit about that. What's behind that? What's it about?
The idea of this song is sort of imagining a sort of a prostitute, a woman, but a streetwalker, a woman who has to work on the street, and sort of coming to grips not only all the pain and physical assault that she's been through in her whole life, but then she sort of crossed paths with this homeless man on the street, and they don't simply commiserate together. In this, she sort of, in this experience and in all her longing against her oppression, sort of sees that she doesn't want to just stop and end her own conditions of enslavement, but wants to give her life to seeing all of humanity be free. And that's the idea of She Craves Spring, not for herself all alone. It's actually a borrowing from a poem called Ode to a Plum Blossom from the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And the idea being she craves spring. She wants to be free, not just for herself, for all of humanity. Artistically, I was inspired by a neighborhood when Outer National was first starting out. We had a studio in a neighborhood and sort of by the water in Brooklyn, and we would spend a lot of late nights in our studio, and then I'd walk around, and it was one of these areas where you'd see a lot of down-and-out sort of prostitutes walking around on the street at night. And I was also inspired by this song that Natalie Merchant had done called Sally Ann. And so this was all sort of swirling about in my head. And so, yeah, I thought it would be pretty important to write a song like this. And so it's a song that we're proud of, She Craves Spring.
You know, one of the things I read something from, I don't know whether it was you or Leo, who was interviewed and talked about this and said that basically the songs on the album were to support the expression of standing up against the oppression of women, but also to challenge everyone, as you're saying, even these women, to look at the real possibility of a different future, a revolutionary new society. And I kept thinking about this thing, particularly with this She Craves Spring, because as I remember it, that poem in particular was a poem by Mao, and it was written about Zhang Jing, and which is it's a really interesting thing, because I think of probably in the world, Zhang Jing is one of the most, is one of the strongest figures in the history of women, and one of the most revolutionary figures in the history of women, but also widely one of the most vilified figures in when people talk about revolutionary, they look at Zhang Jing and sort of look at her as this negative, she was just horrible for what was going on. But you've cast this in a whole different light. That was pretty cool, very cool, actually.
Yeah, that's true, and probably far too few people, I wonder even how many on the air right now, even know who Zhang Jing was, a major leader of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and someone who was vilified not only for all the scorn and distortion of what that revolution was about and accomplished, but also how dare a woman ascend to such heights.
One of these days I'm going to have you on, as I was telling you earlier, for an entire hour, but I think actually at the moment we're probably going to have to move towards just wrapping it up. I wanted to give you a chance, to give the band a chance and people a chance to hear what you're doing and to encourage people to actually get out and download this thing, man, and tell them how they can do that.
Yeah, well, we just released this EP. It's actually our fourth release. It's called Here is the Rose. You can get to it by just typing in outernational.bandcamp.com. And you can download this EP. I think it's $5. Definitely support Outer National and this Revolution Rock. And then we also have our EP from last year, Future Rock, and our record, Todos Somos Ilegales. We've got a lot of music that we've released. And the more we can get it out now, the more possibilities of getting out there and touring and releasing even more art.
All right, and we're going to go out with the song, and I'm going out with this song because I think that what we've just been talking about is a theme that runs through this entire EP, the idea that the cold truth is that there is nowhere on planet Earth where it's safe to be female. And man, if you look at what's been going on in India, look what happened in Steubenville, Ohio, look at what happens every day behind locked doors and in the shadows and sometimes right out in the open, and the demonization, degradation, and dehumanization of women is just rampant and intolerable. And what runs through this entire thing is the idea that there's a better world out there. And the song that we're going to go out with is Ladies of the Night. And it's one of my favorite songs. And I want you to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll go out with that song.
This is one of my favorites as well. This song is sort of, a magic realist imagining of the feminist ideals, the women, the disappeared women who've been murdered and raped and mutilated from Juarez, Mexico, that big city on the other side of El Paso. been a big issue for a lot of years now, and this is sort of trying to imagine if that terrible, horrible series of crimes which has happened to these thousands of women, imagine if they didn't happen, but imagine these women were part of a big spirit dance in the desert, sort of conjuring up a whole new movement of emancipation.
Well, there's a line you have in there referring to them as messengers of a new world, something like that, and it's really very powerful when that's juxtaposed against what people may know about what was happening in Juarez and what was going on, and then generalized even in terms of, you know, all these women who, I mean, I'm just thinking about this woman in Steubenville, for instance, who, you know, suddenly everybody's supposed to feel sorry for these guys, these rapists who are crying, and yet this poor woman continues to be dragged through the mud, and oftentimes in many places and in many ways. Why didn't she know better? She was, why did she binge drink, you know? And I kept thinking about all this stuff and all the oppression and everything that's pounded down on women. And here you have this song that comes out of this terrible, terrible thing, but actually is a harbinger of something new and something that all of humanity should be aiming for. So I'm going to go out with that song. And Miles, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, man. All right, and as I just said to Miles, I do want to go out with Ladies of the Night, and I know you're all itching to hear it, and you'll really love it when you do hear it. But first, I want to let you know that you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And I want to thank my guests for today, all right? And my guests being Salman Abu-Sita from the Palestine Land Society, Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Territories of Palestine, and Miles Soleil from the band Outer National, and all of the other members of that band, just one of my favorite bands in the world. You got to check them out, all right? And I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, and as I promised, we are going to be going out now with Ladies of the Night.